Good evening. I hope you all can hear me. My name is Maureen Freely, and I'm with the Warwick Reading Programme. And it's with great pleasure that I'm here this evening to introduce Claire Tomlin, who, as you all know, I'm sure, is... You can hear me? Is the author of 7 highly acclaimed biographies. She's done a biography of Mary Wollstonecraft, Shelley, Catherine Mansfield, Dickens and a Certain Woman, Jane Austen, and won many, many prizes, but most recently won the 2002 Whitbread Book of the Year for her biography of Samuel Pepys. She's here tonight to talk about her stunning new biography of Thomas Hardy, The Time-Torn Man. And what we'll do is, what I'll do is hand over to the expert now, who will speak to you for a while. We'll then have a conversation together, and then I hope that you'll have questions for her. Please welcome Claire Tomlin.
Thank you very much, Maureen. I'm very pleased to be in Warwick. I've been here once before to speak, many years ago. It's an absolutely wonderful, vibrant university. You live in George Eliot's part of England. You've got everything going for you, really. Yes, I'm pleased. I'm supposed to speak, I think, for about 20 minutes, so I will really give you the beginning of a longer talk and then sort of cut it short, because I think questions are more fun, really, than talking, but it would be nice to lay out something, and I'm going to read you a couple of poems, too. So I'm going to ask myself questions that I sometimes get asked. Why did I choose to write about Thomas Hardy? And the answer is, can you hear me? First of all, because I think he is a great poet. And there's something extraordinary about him being a great poet, because for 30 years he was a major 19th century novelist through the 70s, the 80s and the 90s. Then he stopped writing novels and he became a major 20th century poet. And that is an amazing, I think an unparalleled thing, achievement for a writer. And he's a poet's poet. He knew A.E. Housman, who was chary of his praise, but did say that he liked a few of Hardy's poems. Ezra Pound, isn't that amazing? Ezra Pound greatly admired Hardy's poetry and wrote, after Hardy was dead and he was looking at Hardy's poems, and he said, there is the harvest of having written all those novels. He thought that from writing the novels, Hardy had sort of trained himself, distilled something into the poems. Auden, W.H. Auden, had a great love of Hardy, thought about his hawk's vision and his confidence in writing. Tom Gunn, if you know, someone I was at Cambridge with, had settled in America, very good poet. He wrote very well about Hardy's use of the ballad form, which indeed comes into Hardy's poetry. Seamus Heaney is a great admirer of Hardy, and at the beginning of the millennium, he went down to Dorset and went into the garden of Max Gate and recited The Darkling Thrush. I would wish I'd been there. And Philip Larkin adored Hardy's poetry. I think you can see some connection there. And he said something absolutely wonderful about Hardy's poetry, which is, in each poem, there is a little spine of thought, a little spinal column of thought. And in almost every poem, there is also its own little tune, and of few poets can you say that. Another name to invoke, Helen Gardner, austere Oxford don, great critic of Eliot, who didn't much care for Hardy. When she came to do her version, you know, the Oxford Book of English Verse gets redone from time to time. When she did her Oxford Book of English Verse, she put in 21 poems by Hardy, more than almost any other English poet, not more than Shakespeare, but it is a very striking tribute from that grand dame, Helen Gardner. The novels are also poetic as well as dramatic. They are seamed with poetry. It's one of the attractions of them. All the novels are interesting. Some of them are great. Some of them are slight. And all of them are flawed in one way or another, as Hardy himself was the first to say. He regarded himself always as primarily a poet, and he said he wrote the novels to earn his living. I think that's he ran himself down a bit, because obviously the novels were more than that. He did more than that with the novels. Another thing that attracted me, for obvious reasons, about Hardy is that he wrote some of his best work in his 70s. That is extremely unusual in a poet. And as I'm in my 70s, I sort of look at it and think, well, that's good. Poems were inspired by the death of his first wife, Emma, after many years of marriage. This was his first great outburst of really remarkable poems. During the last decade of her life, although they had shared a house, they had been estranged, and she had in fact died up in the attic room to which she had retreated 10 years before or more. This was in 1912 that she died, and her death, which he had not expected, shook him with conflicting emotions, grief, remorse, giving him memories of the past, and overwhelming him, really, with the sense that he had, that they had been so estranged, but that now he'd lost her and could never do anything about it. And it drove him immediately to write. He had her body brought down from the attic room, put in a coffin in the marital bedroom from which she had departed years before, and kept it there until the funeral. And immediately, as I say, he began to write the poems. He said of himself that he was in flower, like a plant bursting into blossom. He said it was a sad flower, but nevertheless it was. And he produced more poems in a shorter time than he had ever done. And this is where I begin my book, because I think it is such an extraordinary moment in the history of English literature and English poetry, this death of the wife, this flowering of the poet, this amazing outburst of poems. So I thought, without more ado, I would read you two of the poems he wrote very shortly after Emma's death. They're dated December 1912. Well, no, one of them is dated December 1912, but the other is from just about the same moment. And they're quite short poems, and you will see they're quite different. One is called "I Found Her Out There." He'd met his wife in Cornwall in 1870, and he was immediately looking back to that meeting. "I found her out there on a slope few see that falls westwardly to the salt-edged air, where the ocean breaks on the purple strand and the hurricane shakes the solid land. I brought her here and have laid her to rest in a noiseless nest, no sea beats near. She will never be stirred in her loamy cell by waves long heard and loved so well. So she does not sleep by those haunted heights the Atlantic smites and the blind gale sweep, whence she often would gaze at Dundagel's famed head, while the dipping blaze dyed her face fire red, and would sigh at the tale of sunk lioness as a wind-tugged tress flapped her cheek like a flail, or listen at whiles with a thought-bound brow to the murmuring miles she is far from now. Yet her shade, maybe, will creep underground till it catch the sound of that western sea as it swells and sobs where she once domiciled, and joy in its throbs with the heart of a child." Well, that is a romantic poem, and it's a poem full of colour. And the other poem, as you will see, is called "Your Last Drive." It is not set in Cornwall, it is set really now, just to the moment when Emma died. "Your Last Drive," she's talking about the last time she went out in a hired motor car to visit some friends. And it's very mundane and down to earth as Hardy could be. "Here by the moorway you returned and saw the borough lights ahead that lit your face, all undiscerned to be in a week the face of the dead. And you told of the charm of that haloed view that never again would beam on you. And on your left, you passed the spot where 8 days later you were to lie and be spoken of as one who was not, beholding it with a heedless eye as alien from you, though under its tree you soon would halt everlastingly. I drove not with you. Yet had I sat at your side that eve, I should not have seen that the countenance I was glancing at had a last time look in the flickering sheen, nor have read the writing upon your face. I go hence soon to my resting place. You may miss me then, but I shall not know how many times you visit me there, or what your thoughts are, or if you go there never at all, and I shall not care. Should you censure me, I shall take no heed, and even your praises no more shall need. True, never you'll know, and you will not mind. But shall I then slight you because of such? Dear ghost, in the past, did you ever find the thought, what profit moved me much? Yet abides the fact, indeed, the same. You are past love, praise, indifference, blame. I find all the poems of 1912, 1913, as he called them, intensely moving, and I find that one particularly because it is so spare and so ordinary, and he spares not himself, and then suddenly he says, dear ghost. He probably hadn't said dear to Emma for a long time, but his love emerges. All those poems vary in tone, and they vary in metrical structure and mood. They are very bold poems. Hardy took a lot of risks with the rhythm, with the diction, and with the feelings. They're romantic, melancholy, many of them are conversational. He wants to talk to Emma through the poems. He wants to have the conversations he's failed to have with her in the recent years. He wants to make atonement. He wants to explain to us, the imagined reader. He's regretful. He also triumphs. Later he went back to Cornwall, I mean within a month, he went back to Cornwall and went back to the places where he and Emma had done their wooing, the great cliffs of the north coast. If you've been to North Cornwall, you'll know how dramatic and wonderful those cliffs are. And he acknowledges how awful the long years of their coldness were and blames himself for failures in love. He knows she's dead, but in a way he's using poetry, as people do, to bring her to life for himself. And he, in fact, succeeds in bringing her to life for us. Well, there are more of these poems, and in fact, Hardy went on writing about Emma until the end of his life. It was a long life. He was born in 1840, he died in 1928, and he produced this huge body of work, far too much to talk about in one talk, not least because it is the detail in Hardy that is always what matters. He started writing poetry in his youth, and as I've said, he always felt he was a poet, and he wrote some magnificent early poems, but he couldn't get them published when he was young, and he didn't begin to publish them until the end of the century. What was my point of departure, then, in writing about Hardy after I'd considered that extraordinary moment? Well, I had to look at where it all came from. And, of course, Hardy, as I think everybody knows, was rooted in Dorset, and so were his parents rooted in Dorset, his father born in 1811, his mother in 1813. And Hardy's sense of the past, Hardy had lived in three tenses all the time, and his sensibility was such that he somehow encompassed his parents' lives as well as his own in his imagination, so that the stretch of his life seems even greater than it actually was. His mother was a most interesting figure. Her father, who was a shepherd and then a servant, consumptive, clever, defiant, against religion, died, leaving her mother as a pauper in the village because her parents had disapproved. Parents weren't very rich anyhow, so she had to bring her children up on the parish, as it was called, and what that meant was that they all had to start working at 13. So Jemima, Hardy's mother, at the age of 13, went out to be a servant. Now, they lived in a picturesque village, Melbury Osmond in North Dorset, and the nearest landowner lived in Melbury's Samford House, a huge, beautiful, magnificent house with a large park, and they owned most of that part of Dorset. And if you wanted a job, you hoped you'd get a job through them. And indeed, from they were the Earls of Ilchester, and their younger sons, if they didn't go into the army, they became clergymen. And Jemima went to the house of one of these aristocratic clergymen, the family name was Fox Strangways, as a little maid, town called Maiden Newton, between her home and Dorchester, and worked there. And then she went to work for another of the Ilchester's clergyman relatives in Stinsford. And they liked her. She was intelligent. I don't think she could barely write, but she could read. Her mother had been a reader, and she liked reading. And the second clergyman had a large library and wrote himself. And they, as she grew, they took her with them sometimes to Weymouth, which was a fashionable seaside town, and they took her to London. So she saw Regency London from below stairs. But she had an idea of what the life of the aristocracy was, and she thought London was very thrilling, and she developed an ambition, which was to become a cook in a gentleman's club in London. And I think that's something Hardy kept in his mind always, that his mother had this feeling about London, and she was very ambitious. At Stinsford, she was made pregnant by Hardy's father. She had to leave her work. She went back to her mother, possibly hoping to have an abortion, possibly hoping to hand over the baby. Not pleased at all. Thomas Hardy, who'd seduced her, they were all called Thomas Hardy, so they didn't even have other names. So we'll say Thomas Hardy Senior, though there was also a grandfather. He was marched across Dorset by her brother-in-law, who lived at Puddletown nearby, and they were both reluctantly married. Now, this Thomas Hardy was lucky. He wasn't the lowest of the low. He wasn't an agricultural labourer. He had his own cottage, which his grandfather had built for his father. And it was a pretty little cottage, quite isolated in a hamlet. And he was a builder in a very small way, such a small way that he's sometimes in the census described as a bricklayer. Jemima wanted him to make something of himself, and she kept saying, why don't you move? Why don't you get a house in Dorchester so you can build up your business? But he didn't want to. He was not ambitious, and although he was a builder, what he really liked was music. And the Hardy men, for three generations, had played music in Stinsford Church. They played the fiddle and the cello, and that was what really gave them their status in the community. Just after little Thomas Hardy, after Thomas Hardy was born, a modernising vicar decided he didn't want this old-fashioned music, and he stopped it. But they went on playing their music in the surrounding villages when there were weddings, when there were festivities, when there were parties they played. And I think this, in a way, is the most important part of Thomas Hardy's education. His father gave him an accordion when he was two. He was playing the fiddle by the time he was four, I think. Music. He's a lyrical poet. And he had music poured into him. He danced. He went out with his father to play. And the music was... And he heard milkmaids and the local girls still sang ballads. He remembers hearing that. So all that fed into his imagination and into his voice, really. What can I say? I can't go on for too long, can I? The other things he got as a child, perhaps we'll concentrate on the childhood, he experienced religion. In village life in those days, everybody went, they all went to church, in spite of this modernising vicar whom they didn't like very much. They read the Bible, they knew the prayer book, and that language also was fed into Hardy, it meant a great deal to him. What happened that was bad was that the vicar, when Hardy was sent to school, went to school in Dorchester, and then when he was 16, his parents, who saw that he had some outstanding gifts, because his father was a builder, his father knew some architects, and there was a Dorchester architect, and they said, can we apprentice our boy to you? And so he went to learn architecture. And when the vicar heard this, he preached a sermon complaining about humble village people who wanted to push their sons up the social ladder, and Hardy never forgot that. The snobbery, I mean, England is a snobbish country and a class-ridden country still, but it was infinitely more so in the mid-19th century. Politics. His family were famously liberals and supported free trade. But if you look at the voting record, no Hardy had a vote. So they were liberals, but they had... it was completely meaningless, really, except that Hardy, as a boy, helped to pull the carriage of the winning liberal candidate around the town in Dorchester. Hardy had a wonderful erotic awakening in childhood from the wife of the local landlord who founded the little village school he went to first. And she thought Hardy was a dear little boy, and Hardy thought she was an amazing creature because she wore a flounce silky dress with ruffles, and she would take him onto her lap. And when she came into church on Sunday, he would listen for the rustling of her dress. And that was, Hardy himself was very much aware that was, started him with a liking for ladies and started his, certainly an erotic awakening. He lived in this hamlet, which was full of other children, if you look at the census, including his own cousins, and he had a sister born just after him, whom he talked about sometimes as his playmate later in life. But when he reminisces about his childhood, it's always a solitary one. So he clearly sought solitude, saw himself as a solitary boy. And once he was 10 and walked to school and to Dorchester every day, he walked alone. 3 miles there, 3 miles back, in all weathers. He had to be at school at 8 in the morning. Sometimes in winter he was walking back in the dark. And I think that became, it was his first freedom from all other interference, all parental interference. And I think if you look at the novels, you see that walking is a central activity. Of course, all poor country people walked. And it's, he makes the road a stage for a great deal of activity. And his descriptions of people walking in the novels. You think of Henchard at the very beginning of The Mayor of Casterbridge, how his walk expresses his character. And you think of Tess walking through in different moods and different times of year. You think of Jude walking himself to death, really, killing himself by getting wet in the rain and lying down to die. There are, in the minor novels, too, Two on a Tower, the older woman who has this wonderful love affair with the village boy, and they get married, and they don't want to be observed, obviously, because she's the wife of the widow of the local landowner. So they walk 9 miles across the country together to a railway station a bit further away. All the walks have Mrs. Yeobright, to think of in The Return of the Native. The Return of the Native is full of people walking. So I think Hardy, observing nature, listening to nature, looking at the stars, hearing the pheasants, hearing the bark of the fox, seeing the way people live their lives and communicated on the roads, this was very important to him. I think that's enough detail. What I was going to go on to talk about was how he took himself to London when he was 21. With great courage, he lived for 5 years in London working for another architect, and he was intensely lonely and intensely isolated. Most 19th century writers, when they went to London, had a sort of network of supporting friends, people they'd been at school with, people they'd been at university with, or, you know, George Eliot actually had intellectual friends, she had her own circle. Hardy was alone, he was alone, he was alone, and he put himself through a terrific program of cultural activities. He also gave up religion completely when he was under, because he read Darwin and he admired John Stuart Mill, both politically and for what he said about religion. He was there during the reform riots of 1865 and saw the reform bill, which finally gave the men in the Hardy family a vote, probably, passed. And he made the plans for his first novel. And his first novel was called The Poor Man and the Lady, and it was a huge socialistic revolutionary attack on the upper classes, and he couldn't get it published. Lots of publishers read it, and some of them said, yes, this is good, this is interesting, but you'd be very unwise to publish this. And what happened then, how he got started, because he was still working as an architect, but he wanted to be a writer, he wanted to get published. So he humbled himself. He said, what sort of novels do you want me to write? And they said, George Meredith said, write a thrilling novel with a plot. So he wrote Desperate Remedies, which is an imitation of Wilkie Collins with a terrific plot. He got published, but he had to pay the publisher to publish it, and it was remaindered, and it got bad reviews. And then he wrote Under the Greenwood Tree, and Macmillan rejected it, and having rejected The Poor Man and the Lady, and he sort of wasn't going to go on. But meanwhile, he'd been to Cornwall on an architectural job, met Emma, the first lady girlfriend he had, and Emma believed in Hardy, and when he said he was going to give up, she said, don't give up, you are a real writer. She wanted to be a writer too. And Hardy said, it wasn't really in her interest to encourage me to go on writing, because if she wanted us to get married, probably safer if I went on being an architect. But Emma said, no, write. And he never forgot that. And that was something very important. They hoped in their marriage that they would have literary comradeship. and for a while perhaps they did. They hoped they would have children, and tragically they didn't have children. And they wanted to travel, and they did travel together a lot, and they both enjoyed that. But the marriage did, as I've already said, cool down and got into trouble, and Hardy shut himself away. Emma said he cares more about the women he imagines than about real women, and she had a point. Well, I'm sure you will have questions, and I think I've probably talked for long enough to give you some idea of the approach I take in my book. So,
shall we? One of the many striking things about the book is that the women come first in your account. I'm wondering if that's the case in with other people who write about them. I suspect not. Now, you begin with Emma, but you move on very quickly to this mother, about whom we've talked already. And very interesting character, as you said, but you also talk about her legacy, the ideas that she put into his head, the ambitions and so on, and then there's this other side, and I'll just read to you the phrase that you know by heart. He said once, my mother's idea, but mine too, that a figure stands in our van with an arm uplifted to knock us back from any pleasant prospect we indulge in as probable. And what do you make of that?
Yeah, well, I think you're right. I think he did have these two things from his mother. He had the ambition, and he had this blackness, which she perhaps got from her father, who took a pretty black view of things. And she had been disappointed. And I sometimes think that Hardy, who became quite depressed, quite often he would fall into depression. Mm-hmm. I think as a child you don't know the circumstances of your own birth, but I sort of think at some point in his life, you don't know when, he would have found out that he'd been an unwanted child, and that his parents and that his mother's dream of going to London had been destroyed by his arrival, and this may have made him, given him pause. And she did in the end reluctantly have four children, and she told them all they were not to marry. She was against marriage, and none of them did except Hardy.
But isn't it also about ambition? Because she was very ambitious, but coming from this kind of family myself, there's always the threat that if you actually practice, if you get what you want, you'll be punished later. There's that sense of somebody striking you down and try to climb. And,
yes,
and,
yes. Well, she did live. She lived to be 90, 91. So she did actually see him succeed.
And what was her attitude?
Well, of course, by then, she and Emma had fallen out. She didn't want him to marry Emma. She thought Emma was poor gentry. Mm-hmm. And she thought Emma was too old and was unlikely to have children. And Emma wrote her the most amazing letter. Well, she wrote her the sister, actually, but mm-hmm. including the mother in the abuse, saying you're like witches sitting on the edge of the heath. Mm-hmm. And you've done everything to turn your son against me, or brother against me. So then Emma wouldn't let them come to the house at all. So there was this... Hardy would go over to see them all the time. Mm-hmm. He'd built a house close to his ancestral home. But it was difficult. And when they had a really bad row, Hardy actually did take Emma away. He sort of took her part in a way. He took her off for a very long time, first to London and then on holiday while everyone simmered down.
Well, there's a very, very accurate portrait of class attitudes of the time, rooted in the story, but the story itself is about class mobility as well. You wouldn't know, I wouldn't have known, that somebody from his background could have the kind of education that his mother managed to get for him, and would manage to go to London, and would manage to have the kind of life he did, although clearly it was difficult.
Yes, well they were lucky in that although they lived in this remote hamlet, it was within walking distance of Dorchester, where there was a decent school. But at the school, Hardy was being prepared not for university, not for higher education. He was being prepared for some very lowly job. He himself taught himself Latin and Greek. He read when he went to London. As I say, he went to all the galleries, all the museums. He read the poets. He really did it himself very much. Mm-hmm. And he suffered. I mean, class mobility, yes, he made it, of course. He became a grand old man, and the Prince of Wales came to lunch with him. But in another sense, he never felt that he'd quite made it. And he talks about Tess of the D'Urbervilles having two languages, the language of home and the language he learnt at school. Mm-hmm. In a way, you feel Hardy was always living in two worlds. And in one of his minor novels, The Hand of Ethelberta, he writes about someone who feels intensely guilty that she can, it's a woman in this case, that she can no longer really communicate with her birth family because she's gone into another world. So I think there's pain always in Hardy because of that.
But there's also, Hardy is always the writer, the novelist as well as the poet. And there's a, I'm going to read another wonderful line. I'm going to ask you about it. See, this is about Emma, when he's just met Emma. He was in love with her. This is you speaking. He was in love with her. There was no doubt about it. But she was also a precious commodity, a mine, as he so frankly told her, a seam of gold for a writer who knew he had to study the market.
Yes, yes, that I think was true, that here she was. He now was in love with a girl who was in love with him, and she was gentry. And he knew from what his publishers told him, but they weren't very keen. They complained when he wrote The Return of the Native. They said all the people are lower class, who's interested in them? They wanted him to write about ladies and gentlemen, this awful thing. Virginia Woolf complained in 1908 when she was writing about Hardy's novel. She said, he can't do a lady. Makes you want to tear your hair, doesn't it? Because he could do other things.
But you have a very, very interesting relationship with your subject. I mean, that thing that sentence that I read out is a case in point. Because you're not putting yourself into the biography, but from the very, very beginning, it's your interpretation of him, an incredibly interesting interpretation. But I just wanted to know how long it took before you felt you understood him.
Well, I think you never entirely understand someone else, and I would say I don't think any biography is definitive, and I would always say it's just an approach. It's an approach from somebody who has spent time and thought and trouble, hoping to say something, point out something interesting.
So you achieve more by being humble about the enterprise.
Well, I think you do, actually, yes, because there are some very funny biographies written in which people sort of tick off. I mean, Hardy's been ticked off. I greatly admired Robert Giddings, but his biography of Hardy, you feel him, and I know it is true. He came to detest Hardy. And I don't think you write a very, in the end, I don't think it works to write a book about someone you detest.
Did your attitude towards Hardy change in the course of writing it? Or is it something that you discovered that forced you to reconsider your interpretation?
Well, because I started from the poetry and ended with the poetry, I suppose, I don't know, it's hard to remember. I remained very fond of him and admiring of him. I could see that he was a hopeless husband. But then there are many. I look at myself. I now have to say, I've said once, all writers are hopeless husbands. It's not true. Spouses make bad writers who are spouses. I'm a very bad wife when I'm writing a book because I'm living inside my head and I'm not really paying attention to my dear husband. And he's quite patient about it, but I think he sometimes gets a bit fed up. I think this does happen in Hardy, infinitely greater, infinitely more absorbed in his fiction and his poetry. Mm-hmm. I think he, we know he went up to his study every day. He sat in his study every day. He didn't talk much to people. I mean, he might come down for tea, but later, at the end of his life, Max Gate became a place of pilgrimage, and he was very nice. He would come down and talk to people a few times. But he obviously wasn't a communicative person. So I felt sorry for both his wives, though I prefer Emma because that was a love match. They were passionately in love with each other, there's no doubt. They were physically and passionately in love with each other, and they had great hopes, which did not come about. But Florence was a groupie, and she wrote to him, and he was old enough to be her grandfather, and she married him because he was a famous man. She did actually look after him kindly and affectionately, and that's good. So that during those last years, he had a well-run home. And
what did you think of his great poetry about his dead wife?
Well, you see, she was bitterly, bitterly upset because he was already in love with her when Emma died. So
she thought, I'm going to marry this great man, and I'm going to be his muse, and everybody's going to know this. And what happens? He publishes a lot of poems about Emma. Well, you have to be very wise and very understanding as a second wife to accept that your husband had a first wife who still represents for him youth and love, however much he loves you. And she didn't understand that. She was just outraged and upset and really angry. And it went on, because he went on writing these poems, and he wrote very few more poems for Florence. Poor Florence. And also the war came. They married in 1914, the war came out, so all this grand life she'd expected of being in London and Cambridge and meeting famous people, they were stuck in Maxgate all through the war, and Hardy was more interested in giving comfort to the German prisoners in the German prisoners' war camp, which he did very, very nobly. And Florence took refuge in being ill all the time, and she had a surgeon in London who was just recommending small operations. So she loved going to the nursing home.
Got more attention there, didn't she?
Well, yes. And you have to see both sides, don't you? You have to see how awful it was for her. And yet she had chosen it. She didn't have to do it. She had to marry her.
I'm wondering if any of you have any questions, and if you do, could you try to speak up, and if you, if we can't hear you, I'll repeat it because this event is being taped. Do any of you have the courage to ask a question? Over here.
What's your view on Harley's famous fatalistic philosophy?
Well, the roots of that are partly his mother's views, partly reading Schopenhauer and German philosophers. Partly, I think, he loved Shelley, and Shelley's poem, Mont Blanc, talks about a power that is neither good nor bad, nor, that just reigns, the power reigns. I mean, Hardy was accused of being always depressed about everything, and not entirely true. He was sometimes very depressed, and he wrote some very gloomy poems, and in The Dynasts, he uses the spirits and some of them, and he talks about the imminent will. And in his wonderful poem about the sinking of the Titanic, he makes the imminent will say, now the ship and the iceberg will hit. I think it's a perfectly reasonable... He would say it was just a metaphor, it was just a way of talking about it. However, I do think, and I do say in my book, that there's a period in his novel writing when he begins to coerce his characters. And you actually feel, particularly in Jude, you actually want to say, no, wait a minute. You know, Jude, when Jude, something happened, and he wants someone to come and help him, and nobody came, Hardy says, because nobody does come. And then you think, well, wait a minute, that's not true. Sometimes somebody does come. Somebody did come for Hardy sometimes. He had his friend Horace Moore who helped him with his education. And you feel he is actually twisting things. And then I looked at the manuscript of Jude the Obscure in the Fitzwilliam in Cambridge, and what you see is that, you know, the appalling episode at the end when his son hangs with the other children and himself because he believes he's heard Sue say there are too many of them. Harley originally gave them only one younger child, so that little Father Time hangs in one child and himself. Harley went back to the manuscript and wrote in another child. And at that point I thought, well, I see what you're doing, but why are you doing it? And I think it was a sort of, I'm going to make people see how absolutely dreadful things can be. And it perhaps would have been... And his friend Rider Haggard, when his little son died, Hardy wrote him a letter of consolation saying, actually, it's really better for your child to die because the world is such an awful place. And I think Rider Haggard was nice enough to see, well, this is Tom being, being Tom. But he had other friends with children whom he loved, and I don't think he wanted the woman to die. He just somehow got into that state. And he wrote a lot of poetry, which is full of joy and pleasure and about dancing and about the weather and about the stories of people, and particularly about animals and plants. So you get a huge variety of responses to the universe in Hardy. But he maintained his refusal to believe in Christian doctrine. He loved it. He loved it historically. He loved the churches. He loved the fact that his people had always been religious, and he loved the language. And he wrote poems which are beautifully balanced, in which he's not believing, but he has this feeling of tenderness towards what people have believed, which seems to me, I'm not a believer either, but I have that same feeling that it has been a most beautiful and wonderful thing that people have believed. I'm in the middle of reading Richard Dawkins at the moment. He might not approve of what I
said. We won't tell him. Is there another question out there? Yes.
What it is about biography that appeals to me. Well, I never set out to be a biographer at all. I wanted to investigate things, and it sort of happened. I mean, in fact, my book about Nellie Turner and Dickens is not really a biography, it's a sort of cultural essay. And I've just sort of been very lucky in that I've been able to think, well, I'm interested in this person and this period and what's going on. So I'm going to try and find out as much as I can about it and write something about it. I'm always a bit nervous about being called a biographer. It sounds somehow a bit, I don't know. I just like to be a writer, really.
And you think that you will be doing something different next time, yes?
I don't know what I'm going to do. I may do another, because I had great fun doing this. Penguin asked me to do this selection of Hardy poems. And I just finished the book, and I was completely exhausted. He said, oh, it'd be nice to have a collection of poems with a one-page introduction, your own choice of poems, and can we have it next week? I said, yes. Because, in fact, it was easy, because it was all in my mind. You know, the poems were very freshly in my mind. But they've now said I could do another poet, any poet I like. That's nice, isn't it? Mm. So I might do that next.
But it has to be a classic poet, yes?
Yes, I'm thinking of doing Milton, because I'd quite like to get back into the 17th century, because I so enjoyed the 17th century. Because the 17th century seemed to me such a lively and important period of history. Whereas poor old Hardy lived in the 19th century when...
In a house.
Everything, yes, and the sort of grey blanket of class and respectability and all those things.
Any other questions, please?
Yes.
And I'll come to you. Okay.
Sorry. In what respect? Yes, I think Pepys gives a very good picture of the way men network and make decisions and sort of write a organized world. Yes, I agree. It's one of the charms to me of him. The way he writes about work and his own feelings about his own job and how he slowly mastered it, what pleasure it gave him, and he had mastered it. Yes. Although, yes, and the account, I think in the first volume of the diary, when he's writing about the restoration, seems to be very like what we have been seeing in Europe when the war came down, people having to make very difficult decisions about whether they were going to adapt and change or whether they were going to refuse to. Well, thank you. I'm glad you like it.
There are two questions. I'll take you at the back first and then come to you.
It's clear that Hardy was Do you believe that it was like he created characters almost in a form of like compensation in his books?
Could you hear that? Do I believe Hardy invented some of his characters to make up for Emma's? I don't really, because I think one of his most charming heroines is Bathsheba in Far From the Madding Crowd. And he wrote that before they were married. And in fact, he uses one aspect of Emma. Bathsheba was not the least bit she did, wouldn't far like Emma, except in one respect. Emma rode. Emma was a bit lame, and she had a little horse which she would ride about before they were married. And there's this marvelous description you probably remember of Bathsheba riding when no one was looking at her. She rides astride and Harley specifically says this, which is pretty remarkable, right? And she's going under some trees, and she lies right back on the saddle and puts her feet up like that. And then she's very mortified when she realises that someone has noticed her. And I sort of think that perhaps a little bit of Emma there. Emma obviously was quite sort of free and unconventional when she was in Cornwall. So I don't think so. And I don't think Emma actually even made a suggestion as late as Tess for the business of the jewels with Angel Clare, and hardly acknowledged that she'd made a suggestion. It was only with Jude that he actually stopped showing her what he was writing and stopped asking her to copy. So I think their marriage, you know, for quite a long time was not entirely unsatisfactory. Emma got a bicycle. Emma was a new woman. She learnt to bicycle, and she taught Harley to bicycle. And they went bicycling together. She talked about cantering, having been a horse rider. She talked about cantering on her bicycle. And they always enjoyed going on holiday abroad together. But obviously, I think, and also I think people, even reviewers, write as though Harley was an absolute monster, and that he sent her up to the attic. He didn't. It was Emma who withdrew. It was Emma who started going to France by herself, and she withdrew from Harvey.
So there. And another question.
In Harvey novels, you often have dangerous women, and very seductive, and you can
yes, or Eustacia Rye, no, you think you are. You mean Lucetta in the American Constitution. Well, I don't think there is. And I think people have cast about, hopefully, looking for them. I mean, he did have these upper class literary ladies who were very keen to be his friend, because of course he helped them, and he helped to get them published. But there's a lot of speculation. There was speculation about whether he was in love with his cousin Tryphena, which he was briefly. And in London, they were mostly ladies' maids, his girlfriends. We don't actually...
I'm afraid, unfortunately, we were only Jackson would have wished in part without the novelist and also in any way represented architectural scheme. Very completely from that formulaic. But within that, rather wonderful lyric poetry bits. One of my favourite characters in the whole of art is the Red Hood.
Yes.
He not only represents the character, but he represents the landscape.
Yes.
And the third character in the whole of art is the landscape.
Absolutely.
The way that life sleeps and simply becomes a character in the action.
You're absolutely right. Yes, I think The Return of Nathan is a wonderfully poetic. You remember the death of Mrs. Deobright? And she sees a heron fly up with the sun, the setting sun on its wings, and she wishes she could, in a way, do that. And you know she's dying. And it's the most...
Yes.
Yes. I'm really pleased to hear you say that, yes.
So the agricultural revolution is going on in Dorchester. Which is a preface to...
Excuse me, I'm sorry, we can't hear
that. I think that's... we must be conscious of that.
Well, Hartley, you're talking about the political situation in Dorset, which was a little bit before him. His father talked to him about a boy who was hanged because he'd watched a rick being burnt, and he was so thin and starved that they had to put weights on his feet to hang him.
Didn't he see a hanging?
Well, he saw a hanging, but yeah. that's something a bit different. That was later. But the agricultural troubles were a bit before Hardy. There were still some, and Hardy notably doesn't really write about them. Now, when you talk about the novels being formulaic, one reason they were formulaic is because Hardy was trying to please the publishers and he was trying to please the editors, who they were serialized in the magazines. And he was constantly humiliated in a way by having to censor what he wrote and by having to introduce much too much plot. And he said himself of the Mayor of Casterbridge, you know, that there was too much plot. And in an ideal world, he would have gone back. He did sometimes rewrite, and when, you know, when he got to Tess, he went through the most extraordinary performance to let the serial be, you know, they took out the rape, they took out the baby, they made Angel Clare, he couldn't carry the milkmaids across the water, he had to put them in a wheelbarrow. and Hardy made absolutely sure that he got the Tess he wanted when it came out in volume form. And he wrote a furious essay called Candor in English Fiction, in which he talks about how sort of spirit-breaking it was to have to do all this. And even Leslie Stephen, the father of Virginia Woolf, in the Cornhill magazine, made him take out that marvellous scene in Far From the Madding Crowd where Bathsheba opens the coffin and sees Fanny with the baby. Leslie Stephen says, you can't have this, you know, for the great public.
But he did still insist on being touching a lot of controversial subjects, even though he didn't go all the way.
No, well, as time went by, he said he wanted to break the doll of English fiction. And, you know, if you think of Dickens' novels, if you think of Hardy's novels, he did break the doll of English fiction.
A noble mission.
Yes, a good mission. Yes.
Are there any other questions? Yes, you.
And what's sort of the legacy, you think, Hardy had for other writers?
Have you all heard that question? Okay, could you repeat?
What was Hardy's legacy to other writers, and are there any modern writers whom you can see? Well, I mentioned Philip Larkin. I think he had a legacy for some poets. I think he has been quite influential. There are one or two Hardy poems which could almost be by Betjeman. He did, but then you get also, I mean, Auden, of course, didn't write like Hardy, but he obviously sort of absorbed a lot from Hardy. I think in fiction, not so much. One of the things that struck me very much, and I mentioned Virginia Woolf, was that at the beginning of the last century, in the first 5 years of the 1900s, Leonard Woolf was at Cambridge with all his friends who became the Bloomsbury Group, and he said they all revered Hardy alongside Ibsen and Shaw because they saw he was an iconoclast and that he was trying to change what they saw as the hypocrisy of Victorian life. Leonard Woolf, actually, when he went out to Ceylon, he wrote a novel called The Village in the Jungle, which is very rarely read. I read it when I reviewing the Victorian book. And it's based on Hardy. It's quite extraordinary. It's an absolutely terrifying, brutal, and appalling story of the dreadful life of these people in the village and the jungle. But among modern novelists, I don't know, John Fowles, I think, probably thought he was being influenced by Hardy, but I can't. Lawrence was certainly influenced by Hardy. Lawrence, as a young man, wrote a wonderful study of Thomas Hardy, which wasn't published until after Lawrence was dead. And I have a sort of theory in my head that Lady Chatterley's Lover, which was published in the year Hardy died, 1928, is in a sort of sense a descendant of The Poor Man and the Lady, because it takes on the class thing, it takes on the condition of England and what's happening for the English landscape. I'm not saying that Hardy would have written so frankly about sex. Who knows? But I do think there is a sort of line there. But that's only my thought. I may be quite wrong.
Is that another question? Yes.
Well, how long research took? Well, I have to say that there's been a lot of, you know, all Hardy's letters have been edited. A lot of Florence's and Emma's letters, and Michael Milgate has written several biographies of Hardy. There has been a huge amount written, far too much written. The academic literature is, you know, you die under the weight of it. I did the usual things of brooding over it all and going down to Dorset and looking at the manuscripts that I described and following up things like the fact that no one had looked to see about Hardy, whether they had votes, the Hardy men. And I went to the Duchy of Cornwall to find out more about the Prince of Wales visit and that sort of thing. But nothing very fundamental. And I found some funny things, like there was a real man called Abel Whittle living in Maiden Newton, where Jemima was, and he's a character in Mary of Casterbridge. But it doesn't really tell you anything very much. So I don't think I made any very significant discoveries. What I did was I immersed myself in the novels and the letters. He wasn't a very good letter writer. And I went and read everything Emma wrote, and I worked a lot at the Dorchester County Museum. And I read the poetry, and whenever I felt depressed and felt it was all too much for me and I was never going to get this book written and nobody would read it if I did, I read the poetry and my spirits rose. That really was, to me, the best of it, because I've become more and more delighted by Harvey's poetry. It's not all good. He wrote some bad poems, of course. He wrote nearly 1,000 poems. But not much of it is bad.
Yeah.
Well, as a child, he lived at Upper Bodcampton, which is, if you've been to Dorset, it's 3 miles outside Dorchester. And although there's a railway and although there's a ring road, you can still walk round there. Let me say, if you're interested in the landscape, next Sunday night, 11:10, South Bank Show has an hour programme which I've made, in which we walk over all the landscapes in Dorset and in Cornwall and come to London. And I have to say, I think they've done it very, very beautifully. And it is, whatever you think of what I say, if you want to look at the beauty of the landscape, it really is quite something. I don't quite know what I can say beyond the fact that what do you have in Dorset? You have the lush valleys and you have the high bits. Hardy talks about how he goes up to the high points of Dorset when he's depressed and when he wants to be himself. And he says when he's up in the high bits, he says, this is where I was before I was born and this is where I'll be after I'm dead. And I've talked about Hardy having always living in three tenses. You know, that is very, very strong in him. Emma didn't really terribly want to live in Dorset, but Hardy sort of circled round, you know, and gradually they did, and Emma accepted it. A very odd thing about Hardy, this is part of his mother's legacy, is that for 25 years, as the first cuckoo started singing in spring, Hardy took the train for London for the season, and he and Emma lived in London. They took flats or houses, and as they got richer, they took grander houses. And they spent the best months of the year in London during the season. And I can't understand how they did that. But I think Hardy's mother, who'd lived in these aristocratic houses for 13 years, said that's what you do. You go to London for the season. That's what you do if you're a grand rich person. And I'm sure Hardy... It certainly wasn't Emma's idea, because Emma came from a very poor gentry. Her father was a drunken solicitor, you know, and they lived in the remote west country. And Hardy joined these men's clubs and, you know, took tea at the House of Commons. And people mock him for his snobbery, but you can never mock people for snobbery in England, because, you know, that's how England works. And Florence was very surprised that he was pleased when the Prince of Wales came to tea, to lunch. But I think it's absolutely understandable. 90 years before that lunch, his mother had stood at the side of the road and watched Princess Victoria drive by with her mother, the Duchess of Kent, before she became Queen. And I think, you know, Hardy knew all about that, how his mother had stood and watched. And I think for him to think 90 years later, the great-grandson Princess Victoria, later Queen Victoria, was asking to come and have lunch with him, even though he hadn't read a line he'd written. But that is how things are. But he turned down a knighthood. Actually, he asked Asquith if he could think about it for a year. He wasn't offered again, but then they made him OM, which was grander. And Emma was, allegedly Emma was cross because she didn't get to be lady. If your husband has an OM, you don't think about it.
I'll bear that in mind. I think we have time for one more question. No hands. I have a question.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could explain the title, Thomas Hardy, The Time-Torn Man. You've talked about Hardy living in three tenses, but there's obviously something else going on as well.
It's just taken from a poem. It's when he was in love with Mrs. Henniker, a rather wonderful woman he was in love with, he writes, I don't know if I can find it, but he writes a poem about her failing to meet him at the British Museum, where he'd asked her to come. And and he says, it would have been kind of you to come. Love in middle age is a broken appointment, page 65. And I thought somehow that time thing was important. You did not come, and marching time drew on and wore me numb. Yet less for loss of your dear presence there than that I thus found lacking in your make that high compassion which can overbear reluctance for pure loving kindness' sake, grieved I when, as the hope hour stroked its sum, you did not come. You love not me, and love alone can lend you loyalty. I know and knew it. But unto the store of human deeds divine in all but name, was it not worth a little hour or more to add yet this? Once you, a woman, came to soothe a time-torn man, even though it be you love not me. Well, it's a good poem, but it's not as good as the Emma poems, is it? But that's time. That's time.
He's
torn.
Too angry. Yeah, he's too angry.
Yes, he's sad too. Yeah. I mean, he really thought he was going to have a wonderful Shelleyan love affair with Mrs. Henniker, but she seemed very sort of free, aristocratic woman. And then when it came to it, he said, "All right, come on." She said, "Oh, I've got a husband. And I'm a Christian." And he was absolutely shattered. All this freeness just didn't really mean anything.
Anyway, this has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for coming here, and I hope you'll be able to stay to sign a few copies of your book.
Thank you. You have most interesting questions. What a good audience.
And I advise all of you to go home and break the doll of English fiction. I know I will. Thank you very much for being such a lovely audience.